Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, scholars note that the world is waging fewer wars, but that the wars that are waged are more brutal and intractable. How far have we come in the science of making peace?
And first, since March 2014, Ukraine has been in the grips of a bloody civil war in the eastern part of its country. Forces loyal to Kiev fight forces loyal to Moscow. Contributing host Doug Becker examines the causes of this conflict and how is the Trump administration's foreign policy complicating the peace efforts in Ukraine.
Russia annexed the Ukrainian territory of Crimea. And a month later, pro-Russian forces seized parts of Donetsk and Luhansk in the eastern part of the country called the Donbas region. Western nations, including the United States, responded by placing targeted economic sanctions against Russia and political sanctions, including the removal of Russia from the G8 economic group. Additionally, the United States provided assistance to Ukraine to aid in their fighting of a civil war between forces loyal to the government in Kyiv and those loyal to the government in Moscow. This war has cost over 14,000 lives. In today's Scholar Circle, we examine the roots of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the possibilities for resolution, and the role of external powers in the conflict. I interview Robert English. He is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. He is author of Russia and the Idea of the West. Rob, first, can you describe what's the nature of the conflict in eastern Ukraine? Who are the actors and what's at stake?
So the nature is not what most people think, meaning that since Ukraine has suddenly been in the focus of the news, because of the impeachment hearings, there's been a lot of attention. And from my point of view, from the point of view of most of us who work on it, a lot of mistakes or incomplete information, a lot of assumptions that are just flying by, because really, we're not really focused on Ukraine, are we? We are focused on Washington. And so it's a very simplified version. That is to say that I hear again and again that the aid that Trump withheld was vital to the survival of Ukraine, that Ukraine faces an existential threat, that this threat is to the very survival of Ukraine and maybe even the West. It affects our security to certainly all of NATO. And a lot of similar descriptions that would lead one to believe that there's a really intense shooting war underway there, that tanks are rolling, and that the aid, which we've been told included Javelin anti-tank missiles, is therefore vital to stop this offensive or this battle that threatens the very existence of Ukraine. And that's simply not true. The kind of intensive fighting when there were pieces of tanks, mechanized artillery, even airplanes involved, and there was actually movement along a battlefront back and forth, intensive fighting in a conventional sense, was pretty much back in 2014, 2015. And since then, by and large, it's been a frozen conflict. So there is shelling intermittently, quite a bit of sniping. People continue to die, but no major movement of any forces. And it's a typical frozen conflict. And it should be remembered that it's a secessionist conflict. And we do use that term, but we don't stop and think, what does it mean? It means that the Donbas, the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which are united in this sort of breakaway republic or self-styled secessionist state, are not seeking to advance, but to, you know, secede. So sort of militarily or geographically, that means something very different. It means we want to carve off our area and be independent or join to Russia or something, not go forward. So why is that important? Well, if you care about what's really going on the ground, it's important to know that you probably got it wrong if you're listening to CNN. If you're concerned about the gravity of Trump's misdeeds in withholding that aid, then you might think that he, as people say, put the whole security of Ukraine at risk, our own security. Those weapons are sitting in a warehouse in Western Ukraine. In fact, the first tranche of Javelin anti-tank missiles, 210 of them from last year, are still under lock and key in a warehouse in Western Ukraine. So you might imagine if there were an existential threat, if the battle were raging, they'd be on the front lines. So my feeling, I'll end this long introduction by just saying that I understand why, because Trump has done such awful things and people are so angry at him. And believe me, in my opinion, he's done more than enough to be impeached just with this chicanery. It doesn't have to be chicanery that is also putting security of Ukraine at risk. People are exaggerating it, I think, because they just detest the guy so much. So I don't want to sound like I'm defending Trump, but he didn't put Ukraine on the edge of destruction by withholding this aid. It's the second bunch of missiles, and the first bunch haven't even been used because there's nothing to use them on right now.
Yeah, there's been numerous conflicts in the former Soviet Union where you have these pockets or these areas of Russophones. I know language has been one of the causes of conflict, and you have these pockets of Russophones that, partially because when the borders were originally drawn, they weren't necessarily drawn with respect to the actual populations, drawn for other reasons. But also, I mean, there was emigration during the Soviet period, where you have these large populations of Russophones that are minorities in the new countries, but they're majorities within that region. And I think of areas like, Georgia's obviously had a couple of breakaway regions in Abkhazia and South Ossetia and the Transnistria region and in Moldova. Is that a pretty accurate description of sort of the nature of why there is this breakaway motivation in eastern Ukraine, that the border didn't necessarily reflect the ethnic or linguistic groups within the country?
Yeah, you're right. That's a general phenomenon throughout the former Soviet Union. Large numbers of people not living in their what we used to call the titular state. And it didn't matter when it was all the USSR, but now that they break away, Russians, not only because in Pridnestrovia there are Ukrainians, in Georgia it's Ossetians and Abkhazians, it's not that they're Russophones there, they are something else phone. Okay. But you're right, the general phenomenon of a border that was not carefully drawn, didn't conform to the ethnicity, but it didn't matter when it was all one Soviet state, now matters very much, and people are sudden minorities and compact minorities. You're right. For example, in eastern Estonia, the Russians in Estonia are not sort of scattered all around, but they live compactly in the eastern part of the country, which makes it a problem for two reasons. One is that they don't assimilate or diffuse. They maintain a very separate identity because they don't have to change their identity, their language, any of their practices. They remain a Russian enclave. And the second reason it's dangerous is because it's adjacent to Russia. It's more possible to think about secession or division when, it's bordering the mother country, or at least when it's on the periphery, not in the center. So, yeah, you're right. A couple of reasons it makes it extraordinarily complicated that these borders came out the way they did.
And what can complicate this is, the academic phrase we use for, say, Russophones living abroad that might want to join Russia, is irredentism. So, and I raise that, how much of this is, who's the tail and who's the dog here? Is this, Russophones living in eastern Ukraine who are driving the conflict, or is this Moscow driving the conflict, or how difficult is it to try to separate those two questions out?
A plague on all their houses. It's not just the two of them. It's all three of them. Right. What do I mean by that? All right, let's take Crimea, mm-hmm. for example. Because that's another region that's nominally, legally, formally part of Ukraine, but now has been declared secession, had a quickie referendum, and was annexed by Russia. So it's partly, definitely, Moscow inflaming or supporting or encouraging off and on over years. But there's also not just a pull to Moscow, but there's a push from Kiev. Because periodically the Ukrainian governments would tilt in a very nationalistic direction, which had a very anti-Russian character, and periodically tried to downgrade the Russian language as the official legal language, and downgrade other kind of autonomous cultural rights, newspapers, television, schooling in your native language. And every time the nationalist Ukrainian government did that, that was helping push the Russians away. So yeah, pushing from the Kiev side, pulling from Moscow, and then the third the third house I'm casting a plague on are local ambitious politicians in the region. Even if, and it's hard for us to know, but even if, let's say, a majority of the Russians, who are a majority in Crimea, were okay with staying in a Ukrainian Crimea because they had a certain autonomy and, you know, life might have been tough, but maybe it's not so much better in Russia. You know, they didn't know for sure. They weren't strongly separatist. But then along comes a local political party, some ambitious politicians who make this their issue and stir up support for secession, promise a better future. You know, Montenegro broke away from Serbia, from the larger Yugoslavia, in that fashion. It was one thing when Croatia or Slovenia broke away. They were much more different historically, culturally. But Montenegrins and Serbs are like brothers, and they even joked about Montenegrins just being mountain Serbs, and their church was the same, everything was the same. They just had slightly different geographic locations and some different customs and history, but so close you couldn't imagine, closer even than Russians and Ukrainians. Then along comes a kind of pro-independence party, and this is how I describe it to students, why this keeps happening when it's manifestly bad for the people to keep breaking up states smaller and the conflict that ensues and the economic immiseration that follows. So why does it keep happening? And I say to students, it's easy to understand. Which would you rather be, Doug? Would you rather be the king, the unchallenged king of a small country, or would you want to be just a lowly prince or nobleman in your country?
Which of
everybody
course...
will choose to be a king, right? So you have that. That's a kind of a crude analogy, but what it means is that so many benefits convey to being a head of state, to being in charge of the economy, which means being in charge of corruption and resources, and the possibilities for enrichment are enormous when you run the state, even if it's a breakaway subset of a larger state. So that's the third component. Anyway, it was push from Kiev or one of the centers. Geopolitical centers, pull from the other, in this case Moscow, and then ambitious local politicians who, there's always hunger, there's always too much unemployment. These are poor areas, so there's always tinder for appealing to people and saying that we'll give you a better life, join with us, independence, break away, we'll get aid from the West, we'll join the EU. So they're very fragile states, very, very, very weak regions of states, and you can do that again and again.
You are listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker, and we are discussing the conflict in eastern Ukraine with Professor Robert English of the University of Southern California. You mentioned that sort of the push from Kyiv, and I know one of the motivations in 2014, 2015, starting with the referendum and the annexation of Crimea and then the conflicts in the Donbas region, was driven partially because of the Euromaidan revolution. And so the toppling of a leader who had been essentially much more pro-Moscow and Yushchenko, and him being replaced by a more sort of pro-European, a pro-Central European leader in Poroshenko. What is Zelensky? Is he, because obviously he'll defeat Poroshenko, but it seems like that election was not as much about foreign policy orientation as it was about, corruption and poor governance. Is that, first of all, is that accurate? And second, is Zelensky looking more to the West, or is he looking more toward to Moscow, or is the verdict still out?
Yeah, I think you asked the right questions, and I think the verdict is still out. As you might expect with someone who's never been a politician before and is feeling his way, who rode in on this amazing wave of just anger and rejection of everything associated with the old elite, but who's never even held a mayorship or a city council position. So he promised, he built a program on some very general promises, and as best we can tell from opinion polling all throughout the campaign and afterwards, because then he had to win the win the presidency, but then he had to win the parliament too. And his party swept parliament several months later. So all the polling and indicators we have from that time tells us that the number one issue for Ukrainians who voted for him, servant of the people, party, his party, was ending the war in the Donbas. Closely followed, it was almost like one in two, just behind in importance for most voters, was corruption. And, of course, both of those are closely tied to a general improvement or hope for a general improvement in the economy, because the war is sapping. It's not that the war is super expensive. Being a frozen conflict, sniping, a little bit of shelling, mortar fire, it's not massively destructive, and it's not chewing up territory and equipment. But it's blocking development. That part of the country, if it's reintegrated with Ukraine, right, has I hate to say coal, but it does. Better coal than freezing, they think. And actually, the Chinese are coming in helping them build coal gasification plants. At least that's the idea. But it has coal, it has some iron, mining, and heavy industry. They build railroad cars, turbines, a big machinery there. And so it's not so much that the conflict itself is expensive, but it's preventing the economy from getting back on its feet. So when people say they want peace, they're also saying we want to get the economy going. So it's hard for us to say. But there you go. The priorities were ending the war and fighting corruption, which is so, so bad in Ukraine. And that's what elected Zelensky. And as far as foreign policy, he was clear. Poroshenko was pretty nationalist. Poroshenko wouldn't talk to Putin. Poroshenko said no compromise and looked for help wherever he could get it internationally to support getting back Crimea, keeping sanctions on Russia, increasing them. Zelensky said something different. He said, I'll talk to anybody. He says, I will sit down with Putin and talk to him. I will find compromise. And he didn't talk much about Crimea. He didn't take a position. Officially, he says that Crimea has to be reunited with Ukraine. But practically, he's not letting it stand in the way of negotiating on the other issue, which is Donbas. And as far as Donbas is concerned, he's taken a step toward the Russian position, which is to say, we agree on this basic formula that's been discussed. The formula is grant a lot of autonomy to those regions, roll back all the centralizing measures that the previous government took, grant more autonomy, allow them a certain kind of self-rule, and of course, continue use of the Russian language, Russian television, Russian teaching in the schools, all that. Let them have that. In return, Putin, right, Zelensky's interlocutor, they've met, they've had summit meetings, which is more than the last 5 years showed. In return, Putin is committing to pulling out militarily, giving that territory back to Ukraine, restoring Ukrainian territorial sovereignty and relinquishing the border. That's the basic outline of a deal. It's been there all along, ever since the first broad Minsk proposal was signed by all parties back in 2015. But implementing it has been difficult, and you got to admit, both sides are to blame. Poroshenko basically did not like the deal. He inherited it from the temporary government. He didn't take power, remember, right after the Maidan Revolution. There was a caretaker government that signed that agreement, and he didn't like it, but his country had officially signed it. So he took no action towards fulfilling it. His argument was, if we give those regions more autonomy, they'll just slip away and become really Russian. And so he held to that position, and then Putin held to his and kept the military aid flowing. So some of us have been really hopeful. This is what's been so strange and bizarre about everything that's happened since June, since the phone call, right? The phone call and all that spiraled into impeachment hearings it's kind of scary. It's kind of sad because there was a peace process underway. Zelensky got elected in March. He got a new parliament, or was it May? I'm sorry. It was in May, right at the end of the year, and then he got his new parliament over the summer, and now he could work. And indeed, he went to work and resumed these peace talks. And in those last few months, even as we've all been focused on Trump's extortion of the new government and his sort of bribery, you want this aid? Give me Joe Biden's head, right? Well, that's been going on, and that's been our focus over there. The two sides, Russian and Ukrainian, have begun talking. They have reaffirmed this Minsk framework. They both toned down the rhetoric a great deal. Both the news media on both sides has become much less hostile because it was at a fever pitch before. Then they did a sort of troop pullback from the front lines, right? So the troops, the guys with guns, are not just like 50 yards across from each other, but they're sort of a demilitarized zone to reduce all the casualties along the way and lower the hostilities. Then they just did a prisoner exchange. And now it's about a month ago, 3 weeks ago. That's a big step. Mm-hmm. And on October 10th, I think it was, the foreign minister of Germany, Steinmeier, brokered this sort of signing ceremony where they agreed to an implementation schedule for the next stages. And the next stage would be elections, local right. elections in those Russian-dominant areas. So if you put all that together, that's a peace process. It's a long way, I agree, from a finished peace. But we, those of us who want to see the conflict end, who watch it closely, were hopeful and encouraged. And we saw the Europeans working at this. Right. The Germans were basically pressing the Ukrainians. They kind of split up the duties. And the French, Macron, right. were pressing the Russians. And you remember Macron even had Putin to France mm-hmm. on the side of the G7, mm-hmm. last G7, to work on this issue. So we saw all this EU activity and movement on the ground, and it was so encouraging. And my fear is it's all blown up because of Donald Trump. At a minimum, it's true that our newspapers haven't been full of the peace process because we see a different side of Ukraine, and so it's a very narrow slice we're looking at. I'm not saying what we're doing with Trump impeachment, all that for our domestic politics isn't important and a process that has right. to be investigated and gone through. All I'm saying is that along the way, when our news covers it every night, we get a tiny and somewhat distorted, incomplete little picture of what's really happening in Ukraine. Right. That's all.
Yeah.
And I hope that process will continue.
Certainly the way in which the issue has been framed, how Zelensky's number one motivation throughout this entire process is to maintain this line of support from the U.S., and you've reiterated that it wasn't really as much about the weapons themselves as much as perhaps it was a signal that the United States, you know, still was interested in the conflict, that wasn't going to leave Kyiv to its own devices vis-a-vis Moscow. And I know, you know, some of the strongest Ukrainian supporters, in some cases, in one specific case, is not there any longer with the death of John McCain, and others who had been, you know, fairly vocal about this, that there's been this sort of recasting. It's like the traditional supporters of Kyiv came across both political parties, and this whole impeachment process is reshuffling the deck. And so Zelensky doesn't necessarily know, does the U.S. support him? How far will they go? You know, for that support. And so, I mean, how complicated is that in that Zelensky doesn't necessarily know the alignment of the external powers, and in particular the United States, since what seems to be at stake here, and this was highlighted, by the way, by Fiona Hill's testimony, that at some level what's at stake here is the way the two political parties are staking this out as sort of Ukraine versus Russia rather than necessarily, you know, local issues. So it's complicated, but can it be put back together, or are we just going to have to wait until this process ends and then sort out American foreign policy at some point after the vote in the Senate?
I think his country's big, but it's really small in that sense. They're still weak. They still need foreign aid in a massive way, all kinds of support. And like all those countries, they want to be on the good side of America. And since we can't decide, you know, what we're doing, and you know, imagine if I say something in support of Trump and he's not reelected, I am screwed with the Democrats. If I say something critical of Trump now and say, yes, I did feel pressured, and he gets reelected, then I'm really screwed because he's so vindictive. So it's horrible. You know, these games have gone on. Small countries get pressured. Certainly in Central Europe, we've seen again and again countries tug between Moscow and the West, or even between Germany and France, or, you know, the Baltic states. Polish interests are slightly different than Ukrainian. There's local squabbling, and then there's the big parties. So it's not new, but to be heightened up to this level is tremendous, and it's just so distressing. You feel for him, and of course I feel for him especially because he's new and fresh and he had some new ideas, was trying to do some good. This isn't Poroshenko or the corrupt old party of this or that. So they just want to survive Trump, sure. like we all do. And I would just say one more thing, and mm-hmm. then I'm sorry I have to go because
yes.
My other appointment came, but we'll continue this.
Yes.
I have so much respect for Fiona Hill as an analyst, as a scholar, and as we saw, a person of rectitude, of integrity, who really said it as it was, mm-hmm. whether it's about the problems of this administration, the corruption, at least the lack of integrity, and the business political interests overriding the national interests. And also when she said that conspiracy theories and lies are tearing us apart. But I got to say, Fiona, you went to work for the liar and conspiracy theorist in chief. What I mean by that is, as bad as what Russia does, or has done in meddling in our politics is you went to work for a guy who's 10 times worse. If we are concerned about the way our politics are becoming so polarized, false narratives, deep fakes, constant dishonesty, constant conspiracy, and just to the point that people are confused and there's no more reality, then you've got to say Trump, InfoWars, Alex Jones, Steve Bannon, Breitbart, the people that you went to work for, Fiona, are the masters of that. Yeah, Fiona is such a good specialist because she's so focused on her Russia and East European area. But at the same time, if she'd had her eyes a little more wide open, she would have noticed things like the Central Park Five, birtherism, and good people in Charlottesville. Right? That's the guy you went to work for. He has been spreading lies and division and hatred and false narratives and conspiracy theories for the last 5 years to get the White House. And I'm not picking up Fiona Hill per se, but I'm saying that I worry about the future of our country, and I see as much as there's a Russian threat, there's a threat of cynical interference and sowing division, most of that threat and division and cynicism is homegrown.
Yeah.
So let me leave you with that for now.
Yeah, that's perfect.
We'll pick it up.
Thank you very much for your thoughts, and we will continue this conversation.
We'll continue. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Great
Thank
job.
You. Mm-hmm.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Robert English is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. He is author of Russia and the Idea of the West. Please join us next week when we have a panel discussion on the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine.
When we come back, scholars say the world is waging fewer wars. What are we learning about peace and peacemaking? And can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What have we learned from past conflicts and peace processes, and can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Three experts join us now. Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. George Lopez was previously Chair and Professor in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. We have, according to some scholars, seen that the world is engaged in fewer wars today, but we still have a lot of conflict. First of all, is it true that we're getting less violent as a humanity? And if so, what is working and what is not working? George Lopez?
Sure. Thanks so much. I think in terms of the recent data, it's certainly the case that there is less formal war. There's less internal war than there was 15 years ago. But one of the things we find is that when war is still ongoing in places like the Congo or Syria, it's much more intense, brutal, and elongated than we've had before. It's also the case that the degree of fallback after peace agreements try to take hold for 2 or 3 years has increased over time. So we have some good news and we have some bad news. In terms of what's worked, it's very clear that we learn a lot about what makes a solid peace agreement work and all the dynamics that must go into it, maybe as many as 13 or 14 primary factors, particularly external support, the need for economic development plans, the need for full participation quickly in a national reconciliation process. But it's also the case that with the Syrias and the Congos, there isn't the full international commitment and resources to try to get behind a peace process and empower local people the way it works in some other conflicts.
Irvin Staub.
Well, it's true that in some sense violence has diminished, but at the same time, we have such intense high-level violence in a lot of places that it is almost complacent to talk about decrease of violence. Some of those are what George mentioned. The Congo, he didn't mention the Sudan, where there has been ongoing violence of an intense kind. So it's very problematic, and we must focus on how we can prevent it. I think that for me, somebody who is concerned with how we can go at this from different perspectives, but I'm rooted in psychology, one of the issues is how we can develop more positive attitudes by groups of people towards other groups whom they live with, whom they are in the same society with. And we can't only talk about what it is that we need to accomplish. We also need to talk about how we can do that. And we know from a lot of research that creating joint projects where people work together for shared goals is very important. It's important with kids in schools. It's important with groups in societies. Another really important thing from my perspective is to create positive visions that include everybody in society. Usually when there is violence within a society by one group against another, a destructive vision or ideology develops what it is that we need to create for our group in order to enhance the well-being or protect the security of our group. And that can be very varied. It can be nationalism. It can even be the vision of social equality, which the Khmer Rouge propagated. But usually, in the cases of such visions, some group is identified as an enemy that stands in the way, and then often it leads to an attempt to destroy that group. So to create positive visions that includes everybody in that society and brings people together so that they can work together for shared goals is extremely important. I also want to mention the issue of healing from past victimization. People, individuals, and groups who are victimized see the world as dangerous, and they very easily lash out when they are threatened again, believing that they need to protect themselves by force, and they become perpetrators in the process. And we have some ideas of how to create healing processes. I also want to mention the issue of justice in these societies. You know, people who have felt victimized or been victimized usually deeply yearn for acknowledgement of what was done to them and some kind of justice. And this can go on for a long time. You know, in Argentina, after the disappearances, everybody received amnesty. And then 20 years later, there was a new justice process because there was so much unhappiness and unrest in society about the unfinished business of victimization and injustice. So there are a few others that are very important. I will mention just two things finally. One of them is the issue of generating what I call active bystandership. Often leaders don't do what they should do. They also remain passive bystanders in relation to what happens in other societies. So citizens have to become involved and propagate actions by their leaders. And the earlier countries respond to what happens in other countries, the less need there will be for force, for violence, for military action. And finally, in all societies, there is the issue of child rearing. How to raise children so that they become what I call inclusively caring, meaning caring not only about people in their own group, but also about other people, and morally courageous enough that they can take action.
And perhaps then they don't elect leaders that are warmongers in democratic societies. So Irvin Staub has just been laying out the societal level things. Now, Noren Ripson, you've looked at things from the state level. What do we see there?
Well, my research focuses on building peace between regional rivals, a particular kind of rivalry. And what I've found typically is that when regional rivalries resolve themselves, it's not because of societal pressures. In the first instance, it's because of states, that is, state pressures, state interests, whether they be alternative threats, more pressing threats internationally, whether it be pressure from great powers, particularly in an era of hegemony where there's one state that's far more powerful than others, the hegemon, or whether it's simply state survival interests, regime survival interests, and the perpetuation of the power positions of the leaders in power. And then ultimately afterwards, when it comes to peacemaking, afterwards, after an agreement is reached, then if the agreement is socialized and society is brought on board, you can have a successful agreement, whereas when society is not brought on board afterwards, you tend not to have a very successful agreement. Now, on the general question that you posed, I think that right now we are in a moment where the evidence is incontrovertible that warfare, interstate warfare, has declined, particularly in the developed world. The question is whether this represents a trend or whether this is a particular moment in time, whether it's a moment in time because of the presence of a liberal international hegemon in the United States, which has no challengers. I mean, there are other states that may be dissatisfied with the United States and its leadership, but they don't have the capacity at this point to represent significant challengers to it. So whether the question is whether the reason why we're in a moment of greater peace now is because of American hegemony, whether it's because of the spread of liberal values and liberal norms worldwide, whether it's because of globalization and the spread of economic benefits, whether it's because of the destructive capacity of war, as some scholars suggest as well, that makes war at least more difficult to contemplate because of the costs, is unclear at this point. But the question is whether this is simply a moment, and in the event of, say, the rise of great power rivalries again, or, say, in the event of some kind of ecological disaster or even economic crisis beyond what we have right now, where states start calculating in very different terms, perhaps in 20, 30, or 40 years, we might not be in that moment of greater cooperation. So there's really a question about whether this is an enduring trend or whether this is simply a moment in time, like we've had other moments throughout history where conflict was suppressed or reduced for a period of time, but then reemerged.
It's interesting that you bring up the hegemon factor. The last war, interstate war, that turned into a disaster was perpetrated by the hegemon, the U.S., in Iraq. But you also brought up a couple of other interesting points, like the environment, like what's coming with climate change. Will people handle this in a peaceful manner? One other thing that Irvin mentioned was about the creating a peace and reconciliation process. Perhaps we should look at that also. George Lopez, let's go back to you now, and let's look at some of these big questions. One conflict that has not been mentioned that seems to be on the verge of a genocide is the Central African Republic. Let's look at this. Let's look at Syria, the Congo, Sudan, and think in terms of what we know now, what needs to be done to prevent bloodshed.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. And I think when you look at Congo, CAR, and Syria, we're talking about places where all the mechanisms I want to mention actually never got a chance to take hold, partly because of internal anarchy or because of dictatorial rule. And I think one of the things that it's often difficult to convince public audiences and policymakers alike of is the number of cases that turned not into large-scale violence, because what we were able to do was to put in place the preventative or violence mitigating mechanisms that we've learned in the peace-building enterprise over the last two decades. Specifically, for example, if you look at some of the things that were going on during peace processes in Colombia, in Ireland, more in Burma, to a certain extent in Tunisia in the midst of the Arab Spring, what we had was lots of international agencies that do training in everything from security sector reform to police monitoring and retraining to civil society engagement training people in the values of conflict resolution, the kind of inclusiveness that Irvin talked about at every level, from schools through civic organizations and the like, training people without very much experience in democracy in their country to the virtues of broad-scale participation and national dialogues. All of these kinds of approaches have been used since the terrible wars in the Balkans in the early 90s taught us that you really need to engage civil society in order to prevent a war of all against all. We've not been able to do that in a Syria or a CAR, but in so many other places we have been. And these are interesting human technologies, human institutions, ways in which we learn that the technologies of peace run the gamut from simple training in mediation and negotiation for community leaders all the way through how you reform the police and the armed forces to be both more inclusive but to understand a very, very different role for themselves in building a new national order. You know, you mentioned Mr. Mandela, of course, is that one of his powers was the ability to call people to an identity and a purpose beyond their self and their existing trained prejudices. And we can do that in a number of ways. And there's so many international and domestic agencies that do that so well.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about what we've learned about preventing and ending violent conflict. In terms of the international hegemon now, Noren Ripsman, I want to go back to you. The U.S. has tried and failed, or maybe hasn't tried hard enough, to bring peace into regions like the Middle East, for example, Israel, Palestine. How vital is it that the hegemon, the United States, play a role there? And if it's not there, what could happen?
Several issues that you raise and that I want to address that were raised before. But first of all, I think it's essential. In order to bring peace between rival societies, states and quasi-state actors have to have key interests that allow them or that persuade them that despite societal hostility, and there's intense societal hostility and antipathy, that they need to take risks and make significant concessions in order to reach an agreement. Now, to begin with, that means that hegemonic engagement is essential or very important. It could happen without it, but it's very important to try to create incentives, both pressure and opportunities for these states in question. But beyond that, the hegemon can't drive the process. The hegemon has to look, and other third-party actors, not simply the hegemon, great powers, international institutions, have to look for opportune moments. They have to look for moments when conflicts appear ripe for resolution. And any efforts they expend at times when conflict isn't ripe for resolution, when there aren't, say, competing threats that are of greater concern to one or both of the parties in question, or when one or both of the parties in question perceives that it has economic interests that may topple the regime, that may threaten the hold on power, and therefore may make an unpopular peace treaty essential for their own purposes, then it may not be an opportune time for outside forces, including the hegemon, to gain leverage over a particular case. One thing I want to address, you know, with regard to this is that I study what I'd like to joke are the easy cases, intense rivalries between regional states. I joke that they're easy because they're not easy, but they're a lot easier than some of the types of cases you've been talking about, where you have either poorly institutionalized states, non-state actors, such as, for example, the Palestinian Authority, or where you have societies with, in the absence of any kind of state institution or top-down hierarchy. And under those circumstances, it becomes a lot more difficult to overcome societal animus. What you need is a strong state in order to be able to reach a decision and carry a decision and then socialize a decision over time. Absent that, societal engagement is great over time, but it's a much longer-term process. And so trying to engage in making peace by engaging society may take, you're talking decades rather than short-term solutions, and a lot of people can lose their lives in the interim, whereas with a state to be able to take what may be a very unpopular decision to make a compromise and make concessions can actually do that in a shorter period of time, and there's willingness.
It sounds like you're arguing is that statehood would matter for Palestine. Is that what you're saying?
State building may be very helpful. I think the circumstances were far better earlier in the new millennium because you actually had an entity that wasn't divided on the Palestinian side. And then the idea of building state capacity to be able to reach concessions would have been very appropriate. Now that it's divided, it's not really clear that you'd actually have a unified state that it would be interested in and able to be able to reach a peace agreement. So the moment there may actually have evaporated.
I know Irvin Staub's also been engaged in that region. Irvin?
I have some things to say about a number of things that my colleagues have said. So let me start with some of that and then go to Israel-Palestine. One of these is that the role of external parties is extremely important, and they have to work with internal parties because it's internal parties that are in a position to make a change. But from my perspective, it's not only a hegemon like the U.S. now that can exert very substantial influence. Other countries can also, especially countries that have some kind of a relationship to the people in power in a particular situation. Unfortunately, people who have that kind of a relationship often, because of that relationship, remain silent and they don't exert influence. But if other parties can work with these external parties so that they will exert influence, like, for example, the Arab countries in relation to Israel-Palestine, that can make a tremendous difference. Also, and among other things, the media can be very powerful in creating change. So, for example, in Macedonia, where there was violence between groups there, a number of journalists from different ethnic groups came together, went and interviewed people belonging to these different ethnic groups, and wrote stories about their lives, lives that were extremely similar. And then they publish these stories in the newspapers of each of the ethnic group. And that kind of thing can humanize the other, show similarities amongst us. Also, talking about external internal collaboration, various NGOs from the outside have prepared ideas for a new constitution in Macedonia. And some of these ideas were included in this new constitution that addressed some of the rights issues and contributed to peace. One other issue, we were talking about interests, and economic interests and various interests and the parties' interests have to lead them to take some kind of action. Unfortunately, ideology often trumps interests. If you look at Israel-Palestine, you could say that creating peace has there been in the interest of both parties for a very long time. But on the Israeli part, for example, the ideology of a greater Israel and the power of a minority that has exerted strong influence in behalf of that ideology was one of the things that has contributed to continuing conflict and violence. And on the Palestinian part, really, it's also an ideology, a vision of how to live life, and that is that there should be a world there, a Middle East there, without Israel. And that has exerted continuing interest. And who could argue with the notion that it has been in the interest of the Palestinians to make peace there? Now, the problem in terms of external bystanders has been that while the U.S. has made efforts at various times to try to promote peace, when it came to really using the power or the influence of the United States, we blinked again and again. So, for example, George Bush the First, when he tried to make loans to Israel contingent that they start building settlements, there was such a pushback that he gave up on it and he didn't engage sufficiently. And I think that there has to be a kind of a determination on the part of external parties who are in a position to exert real influence. If you are a real friend of that country, you are going to use that influence. Now, that means that you are presumptuous. You assume that you know what is better for them. But it is hard to argue that creating peace with the Israelis and Palestinians would have been better for them.
There's, of course, the realities here at home, the role of these interest groups that are attached to ethnic groups that are attached to these countries, the lobbying that occurs.
If I may just add that, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we here in the United States, especially because we do have such power and potentially such moral authority, we lived in a country where we had presidents who decided, I am going to do the right thing, going to then take the political consequences. Often, if they are successful with the right thing, the political consequences would be beneficial, but very often they blink. I went when there was bombing by Serbs in Bosnia. I talked to a member of the U.S. National Security Council and said, why doesn't President Clinton do something? And he said, well, the president cannot do anything because people out there in Podunk would not support it. So here is the supposedly most powerful man in the world who, at least one of his associates, said he cannot do anything because it would not be popular. The willingness to take action that is right and could have real benefit that is unpopular would be really wonderful.
George Lopez, let's go back to you now. You've looked at the United Nations and its role. What has been successful and what has been unsuccessful? How would you say it's doing, and what has worked? What has not worked?
Well, I think it speaks to the different expertises of those of us you've had on just now, and that I think one could take a look at the UN Security Council and say big power politics operates, and you wind up intervening in certain kinds of ways in Libya and not in Syria, and this is what happens when you deal at the big power level. But I tend to have a lot more confidence in groups like the United Nations Mediation Unit and their various panels of experts who've gone into various conflict zones and analyzed who are the people making money on the gun running, where the porousness of the border is, and who are the civil society actors that might be strengthened and stood up by various agencies in order to create conditions of less violence as soon as possible and create more space for political dialogue. And I think that's the UN that doesn't make the front page headlines, and it's not the one that involves veto power of the big politics, but it really is the way that institutions within the Secretariat and associate agencies really work on the ground. And their ability to bring regional actors together, to bring civil society and militaries together in some kind of national dialogue, often aided by institutions like my own, the U.S. Institute of Peace, I think has really made a difference. In every single case, no. But in many more of the cases, we've had reduced violence than we did a decade ago.
And in terms of some of the programs, does it work?
Well, it depends on what else it's tied to. When you intervene in a conflict to separate warring actors and anarchy is broken out, you're intervening at the worst possible time and with only the military tool left to you. Most of us would prefer the work of whether nation states or international organizations to occur much lower in the conflict cycle when you have enough hate speech and you have enough early outbreaks of violence that you know the direction it's going to go, and it begs for more action sooner at various levels rather than only one action left to you 6 months from now, which is a military intervention. The presence of military troops most especially protect innocent civilians from being slaughtered. They create zones of protection and maybe even a space where political dynamics of diplomacy might work and bring an end to militant forces ruling the ground and create conditions for more nations being now more focused on where we need to go with better political and economic development to create a more stable peace.
Noren Ripsman.
First of all, in response to Irving Staub, I think ideology matters, but the point is that when interests are such that leaders are attuned to the need to resolve a conflict, then ideology may take a back seat. So how do you explain the Saudi peace initiative towards Israel? I explain that in terms of the increasing threat that they perceive from Iran. And as a result, they're more receptive to trying to resolve a lesser conflict in order to deal with a more pressing adversary from their point of view. So ideology, I don't think, is an insuperable obstacle if the conditions are right for some kind of peacemaking. The other thing I would say is that engagement of society can actually be counterproductive at times prior to the resolution of a conflict. If you're dealing with non-democratic states, you may actually have a choice of engaging society democratization and spreading liberal cooperative values on one hand or stability on the other. And a lot of the peace resolutions, the peace treaties that I studied, actually are peace treaties with states that are objectionable from a point of view of a Western liberal point of view. But if they got the sense that the international community was trying to go above their heads and democratize or spread liberal values as part of the settlement and not accept the state, you never actually would have gotten, say, an Israeli-Egyptian treaty or an Israeli-Jordanian treaty. And so sometimes we have to choose between, unfortunately, between our values of stability and peace on one hand or liberal values and democratization on another hand.
Of course, the proper approach depends on the exact circumstances. So there has to be an analysis of what is happening and what is the issues and attitudes of the parties involved. All other things equal, I think that the kinds of things that George described that is happening now is of very great importance, because if we act early enough and if we act at those levels, that means that later violence can be prevented. And so early prevention is a significant issue.
What a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, all three of you, Irvin Staub, George Lopez, and Noren Ripsman.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, contributing host Doug Becker, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.